From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, the podcast that encourages community, cross-cultural dialogue, and open conversation. Today, another conversation in our bundle of interviews focusing on writers of young adult fiction. We're talking about secret messages, the role of fear, and modes of storytelling, among many other topics. My guest today is James Byrd, who is a Native American author from the Ojibwe tribe. He was born and raised in Southern California and began his writing career penning screenplays and directing such films as Eat Spirit Eat, From Above, Honey Glue, and We Are Boats. He met his wife, New York Times best-selling author Adriana Mather, at a nightclub in Hollywood. Together they moved to the East Coast, where they both write books, rescue animals, and raise their son, Wolf. James's favorite food is Rice Krispie Treats, and his favorite color is green. His goals in life are to be a great dad, one day open a vegan diner, and write enough books to fill up a bookshelf. James Byrd, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great having you here. Congratulations on your debut novel, The Brave, which was released this summer.
Yeah, thank you.
Just give us a summary of the book and let us know which themes were most important to you as you were writing it.
Okay, so I guess a summary of the book would be, well, it kind of starts off autobiographical. Like, I am half Ojibwe. My main character is half Ojibwe. My main character never met one parent. In his case, it's his mom. I never in real life met my dad. And then the story kind of takes its own life where he has a learning disability, same as I had. But his was a unique one where if someone spoke to him, he would have to count the letters of every word that anyone says to him that's addressed to him. And so it's really hard for him to make friends. He's bullied all the time. His dad doesn't really connect with his son the way that he would hope. So in middle school, he gets shipped off to live with his mother, who he's never met. And he gets a taste of the Ojibwe culture. And the book is basically showing how in one walk of life, something could be a curse, but that exact same thing in a different walk of life could be a gift.
That's lovely. That's lovely. Interesting. I haven't had the luxury of reading your whole book, but I did read the first few chapters, and it's beautiful. I'm looking forward to reading the whole thing.
Oh, thank you. I
didn't realize. I mean, I guess I always wonder, like, how much of the author is in this work of fiction. And you just mentioned that it is sort of autobiographical. While I was reading and, you know, picking up on this device of this is a kid who is fixated on, you know, words and letters, and he feels like he can't get beyond having to count them. I had this thing when I was little where after I learned to type, I guess I wasn't that little because I learned to type in high school, but after I learned to type, everything I heard, I had to like type it out in my head. So
oh, yeah.
I'm curious what your thing was. I mean, did you or do you do something similar to that or similar to your character?
So I have a few things. Like as you're talking, my hand down there is actually writing in cursive what you're saying, and I don't know why I do that. That was never like a learning disability aspect. That's just something that I always do. As you're talking, I'm trying to keep up with your voice with my finger. But my learning disability was every time, like, I had any homework assignment, any exam, any test in school, I would take all the letters from that sheet of paper. I would scramble all the letters, and I would make my own story or make my own sentence. And I would borrow vowels from this word and borrow vowels from that word to create this word. And I would, you know, like use the period over here to be a part. Like I would scramble and dissect words nonstop. So the teachers had no idea what to do with me. Looking back now,
did they know that you were doing that?
What?
Did they know that you were doing that?
Yeah, because I would turn that in as homework. You know, like they'd. I would turn it in and be like, I didn't do your assignment, but I wrote a story with all the letters. And they're like, why would you do that? You know?
Wow.
But yeah, they didn't know what to do with me. So I was always placed in the, you know, slower classes and all that. But it's, I look back now and I find it funny. But back then it was like, the obvious thing to do. Like it's crazy how my brain kept, like, you know, all those questions, like if Janie had three apples and Samantha had six pears and Thomas had four bananas, you know, all that stuff, and they would come up with questions, math question. But my brain, I would honestly go on, like, turn the paper over and be like, whoa, first, let's get to know Samantha. Like, who is she? Like, where does she live? Is she, you know, is she hungry? Why won't Thomas just give her bananas and she would share the pears? Like, this is the way it could work. And, you know, Katie, like, should we trust her? Like, she just, you know, like, did she just move in? Like, we don't know anything about her. Like, let's all just have them, you know. I would do this thing, and it would be common sense to me. Like, I would look around and be like, how is everyone not asking these questions? We got to get to know these people before we, you know, before we, like, see them as problems, you know?
Right. Or just reduce the whole thing to, like, how many pieces of fruit they have in total, right?
Yeah. And just be like, let's just do a picnic.
Exactly. Did you ever think about, you know, as you got older and you had conversations like this one, like telling people as an adult, telling other people how you approached those problems and what you were like as a student. Did you ever think about being a teacher, or did you ever sort of turn it around and think, I wish my teachers had done XYZ?
So, like, I love the thought of teaching. I love, but I guess I can't be stuck to one classroom because there's so many kids. So I guess writing a book is kind of like being a teacher. Like, yeah. I get to hit as many classrooms as possible. But yeah, so I love the thought of being a teacher. It's just my experience with teachers has not been great. You know, my experiences have been teachers just saying, just sit in the back, I'll pass you. Just sit in the back, you'll pass with a D, you know? And I played sports, so my coach would always talk to them and say, like, hey, if you fail him, he can't play. So what do you want him to do? And they're like, as long as he just sits in the back and draws pictures, I'm fine, you know? Wow. So, like, that was my, like, and I didn't even graduate high school. You know, I dropped out to go have an adventure, you know? And I traveled the country by myself. And
went, how did you do that? How did you travel the country by yourself?
Well, my goal was to go to Minnesota and connect with my tribe.
From California, right? You were living.
Yeah,
in California?
I'm from California. Yeah.
Okay.
But my whole tribe is from Minnesota, and and my mom's family is all in Minnesota. So my goal was to, you know. I had a guidance counselor. The one teacher that I really did love was one that she pulled me aside and she's like, hey, I've never said this to a student before and I probably never will again, but your brain, you need to leave school. School is holding you back. You need to leave school, go to Hollywood and tell your stories there, you know? And I was like, oh, okay. So that's exactly what I did. But instead of going to Hollywood right away, I was like, first I want to connect with my tribe, with, you know, my blood. So I backpacked through America on my way there. And, you know, I hitchhiked and met friends and stayed with friends. And I did that all the way around America and ended up when I got and stayed in Minnesota. When I was in Minnesota, I lived there for a little bit before I came down and then went to Hollywood to tell stories.
Wow. Well, I want to get back to how you originally told stories, but before we get away from your novel, The Brave, I have a question for you. Well, I actually have a lot of questions for you, which is why this is an interview. So the next question on my list is, when I read the first few chapters, on the first page, I noticed something. I was reading on my Kindle. I noticed something and I thought, oh, well, that's just one of those ebook glitches, you know? And then on the next page, I noticed something similar. And I thought, maybe I need to charge my Kindle. I'm not really sure. And then I noticed that this little glitch, and I don't want to spoil anything for people who have yet to, you know, have the joy of reading your novel. But I thought, oh, I better go back and see exactly where that glitch happened, because I think this is like a secret code. Mm-hmm. I think I'm supposed to pick up on this. And so this is one of the reasons I really want to read your whole book, because I only got to get the clues from the first, you know, three or four chapters that I was able to read before this interview. So I guess my question is, am I right? Is there a secret message in your book that you can't decode until you've read the whole thing? Yeah. And okay, there's my answer. Yes, good. Yes. I'm not losing my mind. And is this a device that you've played with before in different stories that you've told? You know, you've got the obvious story, which is the story begins, you know, you either watch a movie or a play or read a book or listen to a storyteller, and you know, that's the story. But then there's this hidden story within it. Is that something that you've explored before, or was this the first time?
Yeah, I do a lot of little secrets and hidden messages and subliminal messages in my movies too. And I'll never reveal, I always, if one day someone picks up on it, that's awesome, you know? But for this book, I did it. I put a secret code in there because I want to make reading fun, you know, for people like me. Like when I was a kid, I couldn't, because I would dissect words, reading a book was most likely impossible for me. I couldn't focus and I couldn't stay with the written words in front of me. My brain would already be lifting them off the page and filing them in a new word. But even if that didn't happen, I feel like as a boy, my attention span isn't great, and reading wasn't really a thing for kids when I was little around where I grew up. So I really wanted to make, it took me 2 years to read my first book. That's how slow and troubled my brain was. And I still remember it. It was Chester Cricket's New Home. I still have the book. I have two copies. I take them everywhere.
Oh, that's lovely.
But I always thought I would be able to read if there was a magical secret or some hidden message in there, make a book almost like a puzzle or a riddle, you know? And so I did that in this book, and my editor was really cool with it. So I'm really excited. I see some messages. I get some messages from kids that break the code and get the message and send me what they think. And it's amazing to see that these kids took the time to actually find out what the message was.
That is amazing. I was going to ask you, have you had any feedback on that particular point from your readers or from, you know, teachers or librarians or parents?
Mostly it's from parents from their kid, like their kid has a message for me, you know. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the coolest part is these little kids, they're the future, right? And they're mm-hmm. already like so much smarter than me when I was their age. Like, and what I'm noticing is kids have way more compassion than people that I deal with every day. Like, even people my age, like these kids have an extra bone in their body, a compassion bone. And that bone, we have to make sure it's healthy and grows, and we can't break that bone, you know, because
yeah,
they're the only reason why this world will go in the right direction. Yeah.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And I thank you for what you're doing to help that bone grow stronger. James, we're going to have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to continue our conversation back in just a second.
The Listen podcast is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit rafsanpedro.es. That's RAFFSANPEDRO.ES.
This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Bird, author of The Brave. Let's talk about the title of your novel. In the first few pages of the book, you provide a literal definition of the word brave. Can you tell us how you settled on the title and what significance the word brave has for you?
So brave, in the first couple pages of the book, you realize that brave is, you know, an act, is being courageous, you know, mm-hmm. act of doing something, even though, you know, you could ignore fear, you know, bypassing fear and still doing it is being brave. And a second definition is it was Native American warriors. They were called Braves because mm-hmm. They were known throughout the whole land as being like the most fearless warriors, you know. And it became the title of my book, but that wasn't the first title. When I first wrote it, it was called The Flutterby Girl.
Interesting.
And Flutterby used to, that's what butterflies were first called. You know, they were called, you know, like, oh, that the bug fluttering by, the Flutterby, the Flutterby, the Flutterby. But in written,
I didn't know that.
People didn't, yeah, and people had no idea what they were. So when they wrote letters about them, you know, sometimes the letters would switch from Flutterby to Butterfly. And that's how they kept it. So it was just a little wordplay thing that I really liked. And if you read the book, then Flutterby Girl makes a lot of sense. But I do love The Brave. I think it was my editor that came up with it. And you know, even though it was so like simple, we all just like, yeah.
What is there a relationship between, you know, what we would have, you know, the phrase we would have used when we were kids, I don't know if this is still used anymore, but an Indian brave, you know, a brave as a noun. What's the relationship between that and the adjective?
So the brave, just like brave is another word for warrior or another word for fighter or another mm-hmm. word. It was just someone that was fearless going into battle, you know. And Indian, do you know why Native Americans are called Indians?
I do. Yeah, because of Columbus, right? Because Columbus thought he'd be arriving in India. Do you want to go ahead and tell that story for anyone out there who might not know?
Yeah, so Columbus was a very stupid man. And so do you want to... all right, so Columbus got financed to explore a new land, but his trip was to go to India, find a new route to India. And he got lost on the way there and ended up, I think where he actually ended up was the Bahamas or the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, down in the islands, right?
Yeah, it was somewhere in the Mediterranean and, or no, the Caribbean, right?
Right.
And, and when he saw the natives there, he still thought he was in India. So he started calling them all Indians. And for some reason, that name never, no one corrected him and said, wow, you're like half the world off, you know.
Right.
No one corrected him. So still to this day, some people say Indians.
Well, you know, one thing that stands out for me when you, when going back to your title, one thing that stands out for me when you describe the adjective brave is that, you know, it's acting in the face of fear. And so by definition, there has to be fear before you can be brave, before you can be courageous. Yeah. And so often people think, oh, you know, I wish I weren't afraid, or I wish there were an absence of fear. But in fact, if there's an absence of fear, there's no possibility of being courageous, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they were called, like, in all the written reports down in the Indian Wars in the, you know, 1800s and 1700s, when the U.S. Cavalry was fighting the Native Americans, they would always call them braves because they were called, you know, because they were like, oh, these warriors go into battle, they're fearless, fearless, fearless. And, you know, a lot of the native, from the native perception, it was like, no, we're running into bullets. You know, we're afraid, there's fear, but we're still fighting. We're doing it anyways. We're fighting arrows against bullets. We're not fearless. Yeah. We're overcoming that fear, you know? Mm-hmm. We're not letting the fear cripple us. And that's what it is to be brave and courageous, is when you stare fear in the face and you say, okay, I'm still coming, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. James, I'd love to ask you more about your experience as a Native American. Could you tell us more, first of all, about your tribe, the Ojibwe?
Yeah. So my Ojibwe tribe is from Minnesota, and it's on my mom's side. I never met my dad. I think I told you that. And I think he was from Ireland. So I'm half Irish, half Native American. But yeah, the Ojibwe tribe is really, have you ever seen a dream catcher? Do you guys have that in Spain? Dream catchers?
I don't know if they have them in Spain, but I have seen dream catchers before, yeah.
So that's an Ojibwe thing. A lot of people think that's like every tribe, but Ojibwe's, they did the dream catcher.
And do you want to explain what the dream catcher does? Or is?
Yeah, there's a few interpretations of dream catchers. A lot of people use them to, it's actually whoever has it gets to, you know, use it. It's like a musical instrument. Like, you play it how you want to play it. But a lot of them to keep nightmares out, you know? But a lot of them, if you have a good dream, you could bounce it into and get it stuck in the dream catcher, the web. And be like, I want to hold on to that dream. And, you know, and so I know Ojibwe people, actually from Native Americans from many tribes, that use dream catchers in different ways. And so I never knew it could be used as like a musical instrument. Yeah, so I was fascinated when I found that out. So like in my head, I thought I was going to have this like vision quest and sit down with the wise elders and and become brave, right? And so when I got there, when I did meet the Native Americans, the one thing that did keep me like fascinated was the sense of humor. They have the same sense of humor as my family, and all the Native American, like all the Ojibwe I met over there, all have the same sense of humor. Like, they're, everything is funny. Everything is taken. You're like almost supposed to find the humor in every situation. It's a very weird thing in the blood that finds everything funny. And if you can't find everything funny, you try. You know, you do make the effort to find the humor in there. But, so I grew up in California. I grew up extremely poor. I grew up, you know, a lot of the times we're homeless. A lot of the times we're living in a car. We're always running from child services. We're on welfare, food stamps, Section 8, you know, like, food banks, all that stuff. Like, I grew up really poor. When I went to Minnesota, what surprised me is the Native Americans there are it's poor, you know, like it's inescapable kind of in our, what America has done to the natives. It's kind of like poverty is dumped on them ever since they arrived, the white people arrived. And, you know, poverty probably did not even exist for the natives. You know, everything was on a trade and a trust. You know, that there was no even word for lying. Like, if you spoke it, it was real, you know. So it's like there's 500 to 600 years of this poverty. You know, we were before the colonizers came, we were 100% of the land, right? We were 100%. And only in, you know, 500 to 600 years, that 100% has been reduced to, in America, we are now 1%. And maybe not even 1%. I think it's like 0.9%. Mm-hmm. So we're, out of all inhabitants in this country that we were 100%, we're now less than 1%. Mm-hmm. So like, that tells you right there how decimated and how, like, how history books ignore genocide and history books ignore what America has done to the indigenous people here. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So like, so it's crazy.
It is. And it's so sad. Have you seen changes there in your lifetime? Do you think things are evolving for better or evolving for worse for Native Americans in the United States?
So as far as I see it could get better. Mm-hmm. I see, like, as long as, so minorities, you know, like Native American falls into minority. Mm-hmm. As long as minorities start getting voices, you know, heard voices, and, you know, like the Black Lives Matter, that's a huge win for natives too, you know, because, like, you know, Black Lives Matter is very, very much bringing attention in the spotlight to, like, police brutality, right?
Right.
But statistically, Native Americans are killed by police more than any demographic in America. Mm. You know, and that's still a fact. And we're only 1%. So that is huge. Mm. And, like, domestic abuse is high, and missing, like, the women that go, women and kids that go missing, mm-hmm. Native Americans are the highest demographic of that too, of, you know, murdered women. So I think this, the Black Lives Matter could be piggybacked by, you know, a Red Lives Matter, but for that to happen, the Red Lives Matter, you know, the Native Americans need to support the Black Lives Matter just like as it is their own, mm-hmm. because a minority is a minority. If you're oppressed, you're oppressed. You know, there's only the oppressor and the oppressed. There's no sideline, mm-hmm. you know. If you're sitting back and watching, you're on the oppressor's side. If you're helping the oppressed up when they get knocked down, then, you know, then you're an ally. And so I think it could get better as long as we keep fighting and keep, you know, uniting against the oppressor.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the word minority, diversity, and I've read that this is an issue that's very important to you as an artist. What steps do you think we can all take to ensure that diverse voices get heard?
So I think this country would be so different if one thing happened, if the Native Americans did one thing from the beginning, mm-hmm. and that's unite together. If all the tribes united, then the U.S. cavalry would have been squashed, you know, like, as is. U.S. cavalry lost 88% of the battles against Native American tribes. So what killed them off was disease and, you know, genocide, killing the women and children. But if natives united, it would have been a very different story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still true today. If Native Americans all supported each other as artists and united together and formed a Native American, art force, like, I think it would raise all the voices instead of patches of tribes, like instead of Ojibwe, Navajo, Cherokee, Sioux, Lakota, I think if we all bound to get united together for the very, very first time, and rose up together, I think that would be a huge thing. And as well as other minorities, Native Americans are a voice that have been silenced for far too long, mm-hmm. but so have African Americans, the history of African Americans in America is so awful. So it's incredible that Native Americans, it's incredible that they survived and thrived and are here today. And the numbers, they're here because they have fought every single time against being erased, And so I think if all the minorities unite together, I think the world is just going to be better if there's no such thing as a minority and majority. I think if it's just, if we're all just a rainbow, if we're all just mixed, a bag of Skittles or whatever, just everything. And if we're all just mixed together, then no one's going to be that jerk that always pick a side, us against them, mm-hmm. like us, we're over here, mm-hmm. as long as. So the own voices does cater to that, to bring voices to the diverse, And there's a lot of debates on how own voices could be harmful and could be helpful. And I think those conversations are very much worth hearing out because it's basically a new thing. And new things need to be fine-tuned and fixed and prepared and, polished into the best possible way it could be. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't think it's right for people to be against, own voices or 100% for own voices. I think own voices only exist because there's a huge problem.
I'm not sure I've ever heard that term before. Are you saying own voices?
Own voices is where, so in my case, Native American. So a Native American author can write a Native American story and bring it to, bookstores, without it being, whitewashed. You get it straight from a Native American's, head. Mm-hmm. Instead of having a bunch of, look at the history books, all history books are written just by white men, and you're getting their version of history. And it is so wrong. Like, our history books, you grew up thinking this is history, then you go to college and learn that everything you learned was wrong, you know, and it was just written by the bad guys, you know? So Own Voices is actually trying to fix that problem of hearing it all from one demographic, all different cultures, you know. This gives each culture the voice of that culture. Mm.
Thank you so much for clarifying that. And it's really powerful what you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, this summer my son attended a program for middle schoolers, and I found it so interesting how they focused it for the kids. They spent the entire week exploring which voices have been recorded and passed down throughout history and which voices haven't and why.
Yeah. Even that question being asked is progress. Like, that wasn't asked a couple years ago. That wasn't asked. That would be, you'd be in trouble if you asked that question, you know, decades ago.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So that's a step in the right direction, right? Let's take another short break, and we'll be right back to talk more with YA author James Bird. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. If you visit our new website at thelistenpodcast.com, you can let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. I'm also hoping you'll subscribe to our podcast. When you sign up and rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. You can find us on social media and check out the Listen blog, also available on our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with James Bird about his career as a writer of young adult fiction. James, before we go on, why don't you let our listeners know how they can reach you and access your work, and, you know, whether that's your website, blog, or social media.
I'm on Instagram if you want to see a bunch of pictures of my baby. And I think that's JBirdcat. I think that's my handle. And I put a lot of book news on there. Mm-hmm. I'm on Facebook, James Bird. I think I'm on Twitter, but I never ever go on Twitter. I hear that I need to start going on it, so maybe I will. But I think that handle is James Bird Writer. And my movies, most of them are on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. Do you have Amazon Prime in Spain?
We do, although It seems like the libraries seem to vary from country to country.
Oh, okay.
But it sounds like our listeners have plenty of places they can find you. Any other platforms you want to add?
No, I think that's it. All social media stuff.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Well, I know in addition to being a writer, as you've referenced, you're also an accomplished filmmaker. Do you see The Brave as a sort of detour from filmmaking, or do you think it's just the first of many books for you?
I think it's the first of many books I'll be writing. I already wrote three since The Brave. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, and book two sold already, and there's a little cameo of Colin in it. So I'm really excited about that. But my plan is to merge everything. My plan is to have Brave be a film, you know? And then I went from writing scripts to directing those scripts into films. And now I want to do more as in write books. And then with that book, write a script of that book and then make a film. So my goal is to soon do everything. Mm-hmm.
Wow, you are totally doing what your guidance counselor encouraged you to do. Have you been in touch with her over the years?
Well, so the craziest thing is when she told me that, I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And she's like, okay, if you're going to do it, really do it. And I'm like, I'll really do it. I'm dropping out. I'll drop out today. I just dropped out, you know, you witnessed it. And she was like, good, good. That's so great. But don't tell anyone I said that. Don't, you know. And she's like, but you're gonna do great. Like, I 100% have faith in you. When I went to Minnesota, you know, I did all that, all my searching. Mm-hmm. And then when I came back down, I go, okay, I'm coming back to California, moving to Hollywood to pursue. When I got my apartment in Hollywood, I drove to go tell that teacher thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that she died of cancer a month after I talked to her.
Oh my gosh, I didn't expect you to say that.
Yeah, So it was like one of her... And she knew. She knew because it was like a month later.
Mm.
So she knew.
Yeah.
She knew how sick she was. And she knew that this was one of her parting things to a student, you know?
Yeah.
So
it almost sounds like she was very clearly telling you to go out and live.
Go live, yeah.
Don't waste a single moment. Man, you should tell her story next.
Yeah, I should, huh?
I'd love to hear a bit about your process. What does it look like when you sit down to write?
So when I write, I do free association writing. Do you know what that is?
I think I can imagine, but why don't you describe it for
us? It's when you sit down and write and you have no outline, you have no notes, you have no knowledge of what's coming next. So every movie I wrote and... you know, script, it's all been, I have no idea who anybody is or what's going to happen or how it's going to end.
Mm-hmm.
I just write, and then I'm surprised, right?
Mm-hmm.
And The Brave is the same. I wrote it and I didn't know where it was going and I didn't know who I was going to meet. But as I write, my brain is watching it as a movie. And so I'm trying to translate what I see happening.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I knew, I thought everyone did it like that. I thought everyone, you know, wrote like that. Like, oh, you're just basically, I'm seeing this happen, so I'm describing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was normal, but I apparently it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how I have to do it.
Mm, interesting. It sounds like there's a clear connection there between James Byrd, the filmmaker, and James Byrd, the writer. And what about where you're headed? Anything you can share about what we can hope to see from you in the coming months and years?
So right now, my main focus is I have a baby. I would retire and just do baby, just play with baby all day. That would be, that would make me so happy. But there's a part of my brain that needs to write, and it's been like that since the beginning, so... I think I have to keep writing, but yeah, the baby is all I want to play with every day. he's super cool. I get to be a dad, you know, and I'm a fatherless father. You know, I never had one, so I'm learning everything as I go, and yeah, I'm blown away by this. You know, when I grew up, I didn't know any kids that had dads either, because I grew up in really poor neighborhoods, and fathers were always a character in movies. Mm. It was always just a movie role. And so when I grew up, I was like, okay, I chose Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington and Kevin Costner and, you know, James Earl Jones and Lawrence Fishburne, like all these famous actors were my dad, because I would get all my life lessons, you know, the father figure life lessons from them. So I grew up calling all of them my dad. And now I am a dad, you know? So it's crazy. It's so fun.
I can see that. It's written all over your face as you talk about your son. James, I'm so grateful you could join us today. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I wish you and your family all the best.
Yeah, thank you to Jennifer Niven for setting this up.
Yeah.
I should send her something for this.
For sure.
This went by super fast.
Too. I know. It was great having you on. Thanks so much. Next time on The Listen, we'll be joined by Michelle Reynoso, author of the series The Girl, the Pendant, and the Portal. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, perched high atop the cliffs at the confluence of the Júcar and Huecar rivers. If you enjoyed this interview, I encourage you to check out the conversations in Season 6, featuring writers Devorah Rogers, Brooke Berman, and J. Edward Croft. And, of course, the first interview in our series on writers of young adult fiction with author Jennifer Niven. You'll find our full archive at thelistenpodcast.com. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. I want to thank our producer, Lauren Lovett, and EJ Jetmore, who handles our social media. And many thanks to Lucas Munoz Jetmore for editing the show, providing tech support, and writing our theme music. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.